There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Exploring memories today with Dr. Raymond Hamdan. Welcome back, Dr. Raymond.
Well, it's nice to see you. It's been a while.
Yes, it has been a while. It is good to see you. We're looking at memories today. Before we get onto that topic, there's a lot to cover there. I want to start looking at the events this week in Las Vegas, the horrific shooting that we saw. Of course, it was at a country music festival. 59 people killed, more than 500 injured. It is, right now, the worst mass shooting in modern American history, which is just incredible, just to think about that alone. But what is interesting here for our purposes and our discussion, Dr. Raymond, is that the killer is described as a wealthy property owner, a regular in Las Vegas casinos who made a living through gambling and speculation. His name is Stephen Paddock. 64-year-old accountant, and he killed himself before armed police blasted their way into his hotel room on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas last Sunday night. Now, of course, he had an arsenal of weapons in there, including more than 10 rifles, but no immediate clue that tells anybody why somebody would open fire on hundreds of festival goers. Now, Dr. Raymond, you know, we're often told that mass shooters, mass murderers, they have a character profile. There is a way to spot these things. Where do we start when we're looking at all of this?
On this case, you don't. We're not talking about a regular criminal who has antisocial personality disorder or so some kind of pathologies elsewhere. You're looking at a person who may have been more of a loner, but being a loner doesn't make you a criminal. Many people are shy. Many people are introvert. That doesn't make them bad people who are going to do bad things. There are many unexplained situations that go on with the psychology of the perpetrator. And in this situation, he may have been able to easily go out and buy arms and pass all the security tests, never had a history of anything going on in the past, but what did that cause him to snap? And that snap could have been a major trauma in his life. It could have been losing a job. It could have been the death of a person. It could actually have been neurological. There's even speculation for those of us who do profiling from a psychological understanding. We want to look at the person holistically. We're not just interested in the social implications because they're very important, of course, but that's not what caused this to happen, possibly. What's going on neurologically? Today, with all the environmental toxicants, we don't know what's going on in the human body. Medicine is perplexed. People come up with diseases and symptoms that medicine can't really identify. Psychology is not able to label yet. There's guidelines in looking for diagnosis. There's guidelines in analyzing symptoms. But do we really know the total situation that's going on? In the human body, there could be a virus, bacteria, fungus, protozoa. Wherever those are, in which cells of the body, which organs of the body, can also have psychological implications, not just physical implications. When we look at the psychology of why individuals do things, we want to look at the neuropsychological aspect as well. So not only is the victim traumatized, of course, and there are neurological implications, what went on with the perpetrator? And again, I want to point out, we may have explanations, but there's never an excuse to do what the person did. Even with the brothers, the Boston Marathon bombers, the younger brother was actually just following what the big brother told him to do. That's very cultural from where they hail. They're a family of origin, their community of origin. But the boy still has to be prosecuted because he committed a major crime, and he will be put to death because that's the crime response by the nation where he committed the crime. In this situation, was there any way that we could have known that this person was going to commit a crime? Today, we can't even tell who the terrorist is when we see a group of people, unless they're obviously wearing a bomb, unless they're wearing clothes that are unusual, unless there's some particular behavior. Not everybody will do that. Many people are trained by their terrorist groups, for instance, to commit these crimes without even giving a lead anymore. So they have had that kind of training themselves to fool people, to get people to divert their attention. In this situation that you're referring to, we don't know the neurological implications that may have been going on, and it certainly had nothing to do with his wealth, had nothing to do with educational background. It had nothing to do with relationships, as far as we know. But who would have even known that he had an arsenal in his residence? Who would have even known that he was a person who was thinking about doing something like this? What we typically see, and it's unfortunate, is the post hoc analysis. Like they say, hindsight is 20/20. But what are we learning from all of this? We're not, because not every person will have that option of showing where they're going to go, because it could be a snap. And this can happen with tumors in the brain that are lodged in a place that nobody even suspected it. I remember one time, long time ago, it wasn't a criminal situation, but a young man was brought by his family who was having psychotic episodes. And he was able, during his psychotic episodes, to see the prophets who would talk to him during these episodes. He could quote the holy book very easily. When he was not in that episode, he had no memory of doing that. He couldn't quote the holy books. He had no indications of having this. What we discovered with a psychiatrist who was also trained as a neurologist, and I worked the case, he had a bad fall when he was 2 years old off the roof of his house. And it created a pinhead tumor in his brain that didn't manifest but to 22 years later.
Would a scan have shown that up, that tumor, you know, in that time, 22 years within that time?
We don't know everything that's going on. Mm. There could be a tumor that does not show any remarkable indications whatsoever. Some places the brain, we don't know as much about the brain as one day we will know. With the modern equipment that we have, we will be able to learn more a lot quicker. But sometimes these situations don't manifest, and they may never manifest except physiologically, not always psychologically. So the answer to what happened to that person who committed this massive crime in Las Vegas, I can't tell you the right answer, but I can tell you what the speculations are. And in profiling, from a psychological angle, from a medical angle, you have to look at things holistically. Hopefully, the more information we get, the better we will be able to predict what's going to happen and maybe stop it.
Talking about the mass murder that happened in Las Vegas this week, just trying to make sense of it all, it's an incredible event that nobody expected, and still analysts, psychologists, the police don't understand where it came from. Even family members who are being interviewed, like his brother, are really struggling to see where it all came from.
He has no police record. He doesn't even have parking tickets, probably.
How did you hear that he was...
We got phone calls. The Las Vegas PD, we're cooperating with the cops. We have talked to the PD. This is like you called me up and said, your next door neighbor did this. And I'd go, wow, my next door neighbor did that. All I've ever seen him do is mow his yard. The fact that my brother did this is... There's nothing. I mean, there's absolutely no... There's not even anything I can say. I mean, how do you... I mean, my brother did this. This is like it was done, you know, like he shot us. I mean, if he'd have killed my kids, I couldn't be more dumbfounded. I mean, it doesn't...
So last...
There's nothing.
Last communication...
There's nothing.
After the hurricane.
I mean, I can show you the text. He said, yeah. You know, how's mom? Did you get power? You know, I mean, that was it. There's absolutely... We have nothing. Like I said, we have nothing for you. I mean, I hope... Someone figures out, because we'd like to know.
Were you a close family? You guys, I mean, you know, it seems like a good son if he's checking on your mom.
I live here. He lives in Mesquite. Where the hell did he get automatic weapons? He has no military background or anything like that. When you find out about him, like I said, he's a guy who lived in a house in Mesquite. And drove down and gambled in Las Vegas. He did stuff. Ate burritos. And, I mean...
Yeah. Was the woman that they were looking for his girlfriend?
Yes. Yeah, Mary Lou. I mean, that's why I was on the phone with the cops. It's right. Because I mean,
what do you know about
we were
that?
Worried that he might have hurt her, too.
Police are actually describing her as his wife. Do you? So you...
I don't... they might have got married, but I don't think they're married. I mean, it's just his girlfriend.
What do you know about her? How do you?
She's a nice lady. I've met her 3 or 4 times. She's got a Facebook page. She sends cookies to my mom. I mean...
Do they have kids? Does he have kids?
No.
Does she?
No, he doesn't have any children or anything. I mean... Yeah, there's nothing. You know.
She must be pretty feeling helpless
well,
when the
we're
police...
We're shocked! I mean, we're just... It's like, you think it's a... You know, except that it came in... All 5 of my phones in the house and the cells and everything lit up at the same time. You know, I'd have thought it was one of my friends. Joking. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, when you get a phone call that says your brother, you know... just killed a bunch of people. So. This is not... So...
What is your next
move? We're going to hope you people stay at least on the sidewalk. We're answering the phone and talking to random people, but we're telling them we're going to put out a 5-line statement that mm-hmm. says what I've just told you, that we're shocked, horrified, completely dumbfounded.
That was Eric Paddock, the brother of Stephen Paddock, the mass murderer who committed the shooting in Las Vegas. Understandably, very, very distraught. Understandably, completely shocked, Dr. Raymond. Completely unaware that this was about to happen, could have possibly happened.
He couldn't even get his thoughts in order because he's still in shock. There's a lot of denial that's still going on. This is very normal. I mean, the guy was obviously very much in pain, and he wasn't able to even deal with his pain, and that's why sometimes you might hear him chuckling, but he wasn't chuckling because it was funny.
No.
He was chuckling because there was pain, and he would rather do that than to be crying because he doesn't know what to even cry about yet. He still doesn't believe his brother did it. And if you heard, he went into some anger phase as well, being angry about it, and then came back to, this is not really happening. It's an impossible dream, kind of a theme in some of the wording that he was using. If we would have been able to listen to him more, he may have actually gone into, maybe I could have done something different if I had gone to his house more. You would feel more, you would hear more of that, I could have taken more responsibility. This is usually the cycle that people go through when they're in this kind of loss and this shock phase. So the denial and the shock kind of go hand in hand. The anger comes in, the guilt comes in. They're going to also have a lot of dealings with depression and anxiety with all of this. This is going to be very much a stressful situation for his entire family because nobody suspected it from the family. And there's going to be people involved that are going to be telling stories. There's going to be speculations. There's going to be conspiracy behind this. But that's not going to really help the people who are the victims. Remembering that his family members were victims as well, as his girlfriend or wife, as anyone else who may have known him but didn't even know what was going to happen.
Of course. Everybody is affected in this. Interesting to receive a message that says, classy program, mass murderer. Nice. There is a reason why we have to discuss this, for many reasons, because we have to make sense of it. It is something that is happening. It's unfortunately a reality in the world right now that these events happen. There are mass murders taking place in different places.
Let's put things in perspective, though.
Yeah.
There are 7.4 billion people on the planet. Unfortunately, what you hear on the news are the bad situation of a few thousand or 100,000, however many may take place over a month period. I happen to live in a community in the United States where the community actually boasts that there was only 39 murders last year. Well, that sounds like a lot, and to have said only 39 murders is not to take away from the human side of that trauma, but to say, well, there's other cities where that many happens in one day, which is unfortunate. But Let's not focus on the fact that things are going wrong. There are things that can happen that are good. Unfortunately, media picks up on the bad news more than they do on the good news. As a matter of fact, I thought it'd be interesting if somebody ever opened up a station, whether it's radio or whether radio news, I mean, or whether it's television news, that only did good news, that they never reported any of the bad news stuff. I mean, how many people would actually listen?
Probably very little.
I don't know.
You want to hear about what's going on, the things that are concerning people. Some people are saying, yes, it wasn't a mass murder. That was an act of terrorism. Yes. But also, I mean, it's not just important to make sense of all of this, Dr. Raymond, but for future reference, you would hope that you would be able to prevent something like this from happening again.
Well, that's what we're working towards. However, look, terrorists do commit crimes. Criminals do terrorize. But there's a difference in definition. Did this person really have a mission? Or was he releasing a lot of his own harbored anger? Was there a major trauma that happened in his life that he wanted to revenge? Well, the difference between the criminal who commits these kind of crimes or a terrorist, the terrorist has the three I's. That's the letter I. And that is they try to impress people with their beliefs. They try to impose it on the community, and they want to implement it worldwide. Well, a person who goes out...
So there are three elements to that that we need to be looking
at. The three I's, yes. And this is something that distinguishes a person who would be called a terrorist from a person who commits the same kind of crime but for a different reason. Like, for instance, nobody knows if this person is connected to a terrorist cell. So far, nobody has suggested that it is. But however, what we're looking at is if a person goes out and robs a bank, it's just for an immediate set of money or jewelry or whatever they're going to get, not because they want to implement this worldwide. So these are the kind of things that we're looking at by definition. The victims, however, are victims regardless of what the crime was that made them victims.
Dr. Raymond Hamdan, he is clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. We are going to be looking at repressed memories today and the power and mystery of memories. But right now, what we're discussing is the mass shooting that happened in Las Vegas on Sunday, trying to make sense of it all, trying to understand how somebody could commit such a crime, but also looking at the victims. And what's really sad to see are victims like Christopher Roybal. He is a U.S. Navy veteran who survived the war in Afghanistan, but was tragically shot and killed in Las Vegas on Sunday. And he was a 28-year-old Southern Californian native who had recently returned from Afghanistan, was at the concert with his mother, but the pair ended up getting separated and she ran towards the gunfire to try and track her son down. Now, the veteran is believed to have been in Nevada to celebrate his upcoming 29th birthday before he got caught up in the shooting. And in his last public post on Facebook shared around 3 months ago, Roybal discussed what it was like to be perpetually probed about what it's like to be shot. And he wrote, "What's it like to be shot at? A question people ask because it's something that less than 1% of our American population will ever experience, especially one on a daily basis." He said, "My response has always been the same, not one filled with a sense of pride or ego, but an answer filled with truth and genuine fear and anger." He, casting his mind back to his first firefight, he said he did not feel fear, but instead he felt confused and overwhelmed by a plethora of sensory experiences. He said, "It was never fear, to be honest, mass confusion, sensory overload, followed by the most amount of natural adrenaline that could never be duplicated with a needle. I was excited, angry, and manic." He said, "Unfortunately, as the fights continue and as they increase in number and violence, that excitement fades and the anger is all that's left. The anger stays long after your friends have died. The lives you've taken are buried and your boots are placed neatly in a box in some storage unit, still covered in the dirt. You've refused to wash off the fear of forgetting the most raw emotions you as a human being will ever feel again." These are his words in his last Facebook post about what it's like to be shot.
There's nothing good about war.
Nothing.
For anybody who even wins or loses, there's no such thing. Everybody's going to lose in some way because you lose part of your integrity. You lose part of your dignity in these kind of situations, regardless of what the cause is. I remember being involved as a political psychology consultant in places that were war-torn inside of a nation. And it was interesting to see how family members would handle the grieving process. When mothers would say, I lost my son. When wives would say, I lost my husband. When nieces and nephews would talk about losing their uncles and aunts, they were saying it with pride because they were fighting for a cause. When that war was over, and they realized that that cause had nothing to do with reality, but it had to do with a few people at top making a lot of money off of the war, that's when the mourning came in. That's when the anger came in, the bargaining part, the depression set in, because they realized that it was all in vain, and they were made fools of. When people can stand together worldwide, all 7.4 billion people, and say absolutely not to war, there's no reason that we have to go to war. And if everybody does that, you'd be surprised where the control will come from. Now, this sounds like utopia, but it actually isn't, because what happens when we look at crime on television, we believe that it doesn't belong to us because we can turn the TV set off. When we hear about these stories on radio, we can turn the radio off and it was just on radio, not realizing that it is our reality on the planet. Which suggests to us, if everybody would stand together universally and say no to crime, to actually stop the people that are a minority, things would be a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at 7.4 billion people on the planet and count the number of those who we call terrorists, it's not even 5 million, not even close. But why is those less than 5 million bad people controlling what we have to go through in security at airports, controlling what we're allowed to deal with because of security issues when we even walk into a store today? This is the unfairness, because people are not ready to communicate, to work together. But we did see an example of this. Unfortunately, the results were still bad when 9/11, one of the airplanes that was going down, all the people on that airplane, the majority, decided they were going to all work together against the bad people that are on that flight. The flight still went down. But it was interesting, those who were able to communicate, what they had were able to conquer before the end of it, which suggests to us that people need to start working together to understand that when we work together, we can overcome the bad. But we need that leadership who understands that as well.
It's interesting that you mentioned that particular flight. We do have a caller on the line. We've got with us Alan. Hello. Good afternoon, Alan.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. You've got a question for Dr. Raymond. Please go ahead.
Yes. Hi. It's a bit not relating to crime per se, but talking about flight. So if I can give you very quick background. So I travel a lot for business, and I've been doing so for the past 4 years, roughly. But recently, almost a year ago, I started developing anxiety on airplanes, especially when it comes to turbulence and stuff like this. So I would really feel very uncomfortable on every flight, every flight I'm taking, and I take at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to get informed as much as possible on these, and spoke to pilot, done my research, and I know the level of, you know, threat is very, very minimal. But I still cannot get over that anxiety.
Yeah, the anxiety is usually the fear that's irrational and illogical, because you're right, flying airplanes and being in an airplane is like 1,000 times safer than being in a car. And even though we know that, we're also afraid, well, what if something bad happens? And it was only a coincidence that I mentioned the airplane thing on 9/11. I had no idea that you were on the line to talk about this, but I'm glad that you did. Let's talk about flight. Let's talk about anxiety and phobia, you know, airplane, the phobic part of this. What happens is you're linking something that you believe is going to be negative with a situation. Now, that situation creates anticipation. That anticipation is anxiety, because there's no control and there's no anticipation. There's no awareness of what could possibly happen. There are techniques to help with this, to cognitive behavioral therapy that a lot of people know about, but simply going through what's called systematic desensitization will certainly lower the symptoms very, very quickly. I can't describe this on telephone or on a radio show, but what will happen when you come in for assistance, it's a very quick situation. It's not a quick fix. You know, you'll go through a process, and the process is to help you understand, or help us understand through the intake, where the problem started, how it got started, what are the symptoms today, and then be able to change that symptomology to where you don't have the same fears in a situation like being on the airplane. Now, there's always going to be a little bit of anxiety, which is good, but not to the point where it becomes phobic or an anxiety disorder. So there are techniques that can be used that will help you very quickly control the symptoms. And as a result of controlling the symptoms, you'll have less of the fears when you do get into an airplane. You can have a more comfortable flight. At the same time, we do want to look at some of the cognitive process or the analytical understanding why this may have been a problem. It may have been because you may have had a drowning experience before. It may have been because you were traumatized in another situation that gave you a sense of claustrophobia. There could be a lot of different things that relate to this that could have brought on the fear of flying or the fear of being in an airplane. It doesn't necessarily have to do with fear of heights. It could be the fear of closed places, not being in control. These are the kind of things that we would discover to help you get through the symptomology. And the technique that we would commonly use for this would be the systematic desensitization.
Right, right. Understood.
So we'd like to hear from you and let us know how things go with you. It's very kind of you to take the time to call.
Thanks, Alan.
Hopefully.
I hope
Thank
that
Thank you
helps.
Very much.
Excellent.
Hopefully. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. 4001, the Dubai Eye app is there, or as Alan did, you can give us a call on 04-423-1010 if you have a question for Dr. Raymond Hamdan. He is clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. And we've got lots of questions coming through. One earlier from Jane, of course, talking about the mass shooting. She says, interesting discussion. I think that the survivors would feel a terrible amount of guilt. How do they manage that?
Well, usually the guilt, the survivor guilt, is when people would have been there themselves, not the other person. And they would say, look, you go in my place. So the person goes in their place and gets killed. Now, we see this a lot in wartime, where the head of a platoon sends his soldiers out and they get killed, he doesn't. So he has that survivor guilt that I should have been there myself. If I had not sent them out, it would have been me rather than them. So these kind of things will happen. It could be the same thing in a car accident where a person was a driver of a car accident and he survived or she survived, but the other passengers didn't. So there's a lot of different ways that survivor guilt comes into the picture. It could be where parents would have said, I wish I didn't let my child go to that location. Or if I had been stronger and said, no, absolutely not, then I would have been saving my child from this. Or I should have not sent my child out. So there's a lot of scenarios where people feel guilt because they believe that it should have been them who died, not the other person who died.
And how do you get over that? How do you deal with it then?
There are processes that we use in psychological strategies that help walk people through the mourning process, the grief process, the responsibility, which is part of that. Depending on the situation itself, even if they were not traumatized directly but know of a trauma that happened to somebody they care about, or even somebody they just saw traumatized, like a car accident, any kind of an incident that compromises anyone's psychological integrity or physical integrity, they can also go through what we call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, the difference between acute stress disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder is actually the timing. Acute stress disorder is the first 28 days since the incident. The symptoms would be depression, anxiety, hypervigilance, exaggerated startle response, intrusive thoughts, sometimes dissociative amnesia. These can come into play as well. If those same symptoms exist after 28 days following the incident, then it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. So what we're seeing right now with the victims and the family of the victims and even the nation who is sympathizing with what happened is we're seeing acute stress disorder symptoms at different levels. When that persists, and usually it's with those who are direct victims or relatives of the victims, or observers of the victim's situation, then it's the post-traumatic stress disorder. And the same type of psychological interventions can assist. Sometimes people will go through medication, especially when the symptoms are so great that they're unable to respond to the psychological process. But what we're finding in the new research now is 75% of patients prefer non-medical intervention, which means non-drug intervention. They want to go through the psychological process because they realize now that psychology is solution oriented and they don't need to have the medication. But about 7% will still need to be medicated when they are not responsive to the traditional psychological process.
We do have a caller on the line, Dr. Raymond. Hello, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, you've got a question for Dr. Raymond. Please do go ahead.
Yes, I do. Dr. Raymond, how are you?
Hope you're well. Fine, thank you very much for calling.
It's a question about my 9-year-old son. He rides motocross, and during the racing season, before every race, he'll throw up constantly. He just throws up at the starting gate until it's about 10 seconds left to start the race, and once I put his helmet on, he gets on that motorbike and he just tears through the track. But he's been doing this for a couple of years now, where before every single race, he has to throw up. He doesn't do that during practice sessions or other sessions. It's just during the racing season.
Yes.
We've tried giving him stuff to settle his stomach. We've tried not feeding him before or just giving him sort of solutions that will settle his stomach, but nothing works. He's just so worked up, he throws up.
Yeah, he's very anxious about the whole situation and anxious about performance. When he's by himself and he's just practicing, he doesn't have to perform. When other people are watching, then he's expecting himself to be the victor. So he wants to be the winner, and he's anxious that he might not be. So his way of coping with the anxiety is to throw up. It's a disgust kind of a situation that says, I'm going to get rid of all my stress, all my anxiety, all my anticipations. And then, however many seconds it is before the actual race, he gets his helmet on and he can become a different person at that moment, because then he can identify with being the winner and he can go for it. In some cases, I would say to you, you know what? Throwing up might create some problems for his teeth. It could ruin the enamel. It might be bad for his digestive system. But if that's his way of dealing with it at 9 years old, and he's winning the races, what are there going to be a substitute? I wouldn't not feed him. I wouldn't give him some, tell him he can't drink anything. If he feels like he wants to drink something, feels he wants to eat something, I'm not sure that I'm telling you the right thing, because I don't know your son well enough. But just in general, from what you're saying, what I would recommend is that let him go at the pace that he needs to. What you're describing is nothing dangerous. Many people react different ways. I've had adults who get ready to do a speech before an audience, and they panic, literally panic, not just stressed out with anxiety and palpitations and things like that. They actually go through a panic. And once they do a shakedown routine that we can teach, it takes about 10 seconds to do it, they go on stage and they're real troopers. They're stars. They are leading a crowd through their motivational speeches and whatever they're talking about. So your son will help himself by helping him, by you helping him, look at what makes him comfortable. Tell him, are you okay with throwing up? And if he says, no, I'm not, then you say, well, what can we substitute for? It's okay to release it. You're anxious. I wouldn't be so upset about the, I would not be so concerned about the throwing up, because that might be a manifestation of the stress, unless there are some medical problems that are going on, and I can't tell you about that. That's something you have to check with a pediatrician on until I meet them, and I can tell you what psychologically is happening to enable him to have a substitute for that. But find
physically
out.
Physically, he has nothing. Yeah.
Well, right now it's nothing, but sometimes, you know, good parents don't always know how to ask the right question because you're too emotionally involved. But sometimes a third-party professional can help discover things because they're not emotionally involved. And they're able to walk the child through. And the child will actually have the right answer. They just need help how to walk through it to get to that right answer.
I hope that helps.
Thank you very much. No, that helps. We need to let him bring it out himself and tell us how he's feeling. But that's really been a great help.
Thank you very much. Day when he's the famous race car driver, he can let us know what his name is, so we'll follow it.
For sure.
And say, one day, long time ago, on Dubai Eye, you heard it first.
True.
Brilliant.
Will do.
Best of luck to your son.
Thank you.
For the call. So there you go. It's anxiety can be just manifest itself in all sorts of different ways, and there are different ways that we deal with it, which is what you're describing there. We have other questions about anxiety that we are going to get to in just a moment, but we've got to break for the news at the top of the hour. But I just want to come to Dylan's text. The Good News Network is a new service website that's dedicated to only positive and uplifting news.
I can't wait to watch that. Thank you so much for that information.
Thanks, Dylan. So that's at goodnewsnetwork.org. So if you want something that's going to make you feel good, listen to Dubai Eye or go to the Good News Network as well. So we've got questions from Paul. We've got another one about a 13-year-old who needs to wear a jacket all the time because of anxiety. And we've got another question from Anahita. We will get to those. Make sure you send in yours as well. Dr. Ray, a lot of people believe that when we experience something that's too painful or too difficult to face, they end up getting tucked away in unseen corners of our unconscious mind. Take us through how that might work.
Whenever something is traumatic, it doesn't even have to be traumatic, things can get repressed or suppressed. And repressed is when things go into a deeper area. Suppressed is when it just goes into a pre-conscious area, if you want to use those old Freudian terms. And what happens is it doesn't even have to be a traumatic experience, as we not remember everything. So sometimes our memory can be fragmented. Let's look at normal fragmentation before we get into the traumatic reasons for fragmentation. The thing is that when we don't think about something for a while, we may lose the sequencing of it. And what we'll end up doing is confabulating information to put it in. And that becomes the difference between memory and recall. Memory is when you actually have a vivid understanding of what had happened. Recall is when you were told what had happened, so you fill in the blanks. So if you have fragmented memory or fragmented understanding of what had happened in the past, and somebody says, oh, I remember when you were a kid, this is what happened, then you start filling in the blanks. That's called confabulation. Whenever a person is really remembering the entire situation, that is memory. So memory and recall are only different in that recall may be contaminated with what other people told you, but memory is actually what did happen. When a person has been traumatized now, they've been a victim of a major trauma, whether it's a rape, whether it's gunfire, whether it's anything that compromises your integrity psychologically or physically, what we now know happens in the brain explains a lot of behavior that sounds like the person might be lying. So when a person is traumatized by any kind of a situation, there's a neurobiological trauma that takes place. And what that indicates is that the prefrontal cortex is actually stimulated. And this is where your executive functioning takes place. This is where memory may also be related to decision making. Now, memory is all over the body in every single cell. The hippocampus is one area that stores from short term to long term. But anywhere in the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, can also take charge of memory when it has to do with decision-making process. So that becomes temporarily impaired. Another area of the brain is the amygdala, where is in the midbrain, part of the limbic system. And this is where the emotional situations might come out. Sorry. There's other areas like the hippocampus, which I mentioned earlier, that stores from short-term to long-term. That's also affected by trauma. Now, if you put all these things together, that explains why people may have a cold, calloused reporting of a trauma like a rape. So many times when police are interviewing, they see a person being cold and calloused, and the first thing that comes to an unexperienced interviewer is, why are you being so cold and callous? You're supposed to be upset because you just were Trump, you were just violated. Well, the reason that they aren't able to manifest with that kind of emotional energy is because of the trauma.
They're trying to disassociate themselves from it.
That's one way that the that's how it looks behaviorally, correct? Mm. But now we know neurologically, neuropsychologically, what's going on. So what we see then is a cold, callous response as if they weren't even there, just doing a report. We also see fragmentation of the information, because what happens in the brain when a person's traumatized, they might remember what happened before the trauma, right? Remember what happened right after the incident, but they don't really remember the incident.
We're going to talk more about repressed memories and how all of this takes place in the mind. It is really fascinating, Dr. Raymond. But we've got calls coming through, questions coming through on 0442 31010. We've got Joanne on the line. Hello, Joanne.
Hey, hello. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Hi. You've got a question for Dr. Hamdan. Please go ahead.
Yes, please. Hi, Dr. Hamdan.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, very well, thank you.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. People don't call when they're very good. I'm glad you are.
I'm very well, thank you. I just have a question. I have a three-year-old son, and he has this, he won't eat anything but fish, and I don't know where is that coming from. Like, he will refuse.
He's a healthy eater. What are you complaining about?
I know, I'm not complaining.
But I want to ask you, does he like hamur, or does he like bass, or what does he like?
Oh, any type of fish, he's for it. So I've tried so many times, like seriously, he won't eat anything but fish. And I find it a bit worrying every day. It's a good thing, I'm not complaining.
Good.
But I just don't know where is it coming from. I mean, he has a sister who is older than him, and she will eat pretty much everything. Even if she doesn't like something and you force her, she'll eat it. But I've tried one day just to not give him, and he would rather starve than not to eat. I didn't go ahead with it, and I just put him back, and that's the way it is.
Let me tell you what I've learned from dietitians and nutritionists who work with children. Children are part of the human race. They're not another entity that one day will grow up and understand. They're actually human bodies who are created to produce energy and produce waste. And the human body asks for its own balance. The research that was done in the early 80s at Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C., they got permission from parents to feed the children anything that the child asked for. So here's these kids who were 3 years old, 5 years old, 8 years old, 12 years old, were asking for hot dogs and hamburgers for breakfast. They were asking for French fries any time of the day or night, milkshakes, anything they wanted, Coca-Cola, anything they wanted. I'm not advertising one more than the other, but it just happened to be the term that came out. What was interesting, in less than 36 hours, these same children all of a sudden started asking for eggs, for applesauce, for mashed potatoes, for green beans, for steak, for all the healthy kinds of food, because the body was saying, now I've got to get a better balance. So those foods that I think I want are just temporary enjoyment or some kind of possible addiction. But then the body starts to ask for the better balance, and they'll start asking for certain foods and water and things like that. So when I'd say, What I would say to a father of a two-year-old is, I can appreciate your concern, but God bless the fact that you're only concerned about eating healthy foods.
I know.
I wouldn't worry about it. It's not going to get any better than that. That is brilliant.
Then he'll
balance out when he needs some. When his body says, "I need proteins," or "I need carbohydrates," or "I need anything else that's part of the diet that I can't intelligently talk about because it's not my specialty," the body will say, "This is what I need," and he'll ask for those things.
Okay.
It's kind of like, you know, even when we eat, when adults eat, if you have a big binge on, you know, junk food, your body rejects it after a while and says,
yes, exactly,
you've got to stop, and you've got to give me proper food.
And you start needing rubbish, and you really need, your body tells you what you, you know, how many of us drink water? Unless we're told we have to. You know, sometimes people forget to drink water, but eventually your body says, look, buddy, I'm thirsty.
Yeah.
And you're not getting enough water through the food that you're eating. I need to have a fresh glass of water if there's even such a thing anymore.
Joanne, all the best with your son.
Do you have another question? Did you have another question you wanted to ask?
Yeah, please, if you don't mind. It's still the same kid. He's a phenomenon. So if he has a drop of water on his clothes or any friction of dirt, he will instantly remove his clothes. So he's a maniac as well. So I don't know where is all of this coming from.
I'm not sure I would use that same word. Yeah, but he's not a bad kid. Some kids, it's not that he's obsessive compulsive, but children sometimes are very sensitive, especially at the age of 2 years old. Their bodies are very sensitive. And this is where parents make a mistake. They'll put something in their mouth and say, this is not hot. It's warm. But to that little body, to that little fragile, sensitive body, that's hot. And parents don't realize that. So when we think, okay, that's just a little smudge of dirt or a little drop of urine or water that may have fell on the body, to us it might not feel anything as adults, but for that child it can be actually an irritant. Respect the fact that he needs to change clothes. Respect the fact that he's not an obsessive compulsive child. You're not going to make a psychologist rich by taking your son there.
Joanne, is this your first child?
Oh, no, he's my second. His sister, he's just fine.
Okay.
But, I mean, I'm having fun with it. It's not a complaint.
Keep enjoying it. Eat fish.
Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. And that was Joanne asking about his son. They just get very picky. And they, from one moment to the next, from what I know about two-year-olds, they just want everything to be different. You know, they could change their mind tomorrow. He could say, I want broccoli tomorrow. He could say, I'm not taking off my clothes, even though they're full of mud tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, kids are really great, especially when they learn that they have control. And the terrible twos only last for about 23 years. And it's great because I've even heard stories of where a kid will say, no, I don't want to wear these pants. But you have to wear these pants. We're going to a birthday party. No, I'm not going to wear these pants. No, you have to wear these pants. Well, guess what the child will do by the time we get in the car? They'll pee on themselves to prove that they're not going to wear those pants. And that's how they pay their power game.
Yes.
And their terrible twos means that the child has found that they actually have control. They know how to use the no word.
Oh, lots to discuss with the little ones, but let's get to more of those text questions. Paul sent in a question earlier saying, I get palpitations when I get when I have to do presentations, though I know the subject very well. On a personal side, I'm extremely fearful of death. If someone who is known to me passes away, I link that to myself. And for days, I am fearful and palpitations continue. And it takes time to overcome that fear. How do I overcome the situation?
What you're talking about right now, and I don't pretend I know your case because you were kind enough to write in a few lines, but it would take at least a full session to get a complete intake understanding of all the symptoms to make a correct diagnosis. But from what you're saying, we're not looking at just anxiety here, we're looking at a phobia. And the difference is, when you look at anxiety, which is different than fear, fear is when there really is a stimulant there, like a bear, and you're scared of that bear because that's a big animal that could hurt you. Anxiety is when there is no bear, but you still have the same fears as if there was a bear there. So anxiety is irrational and illogical fear. When it becomes a phobia, the interesting thing, the undercurrent psychological issues of phobia is the fear of death.
Mm.
And that is more than just the anxiety. Now you're linking your anxiety to a specific situation or a place or a person where you're afraid of death. So it doesn't surprise me that even though the death issue may not come up during that anxiety episode, but it does come up elsewhere. There's no way I'm going to tell you on the radio what it is that you can do, because this is a process that needs psychological intervention. It may not need medication, but if it does, there are qualified psychiatrists who will be able to correctly medicate while you're getting psychological intervention. And it is a process that is well known. There's nothing new about it. This is not unique. It won't take forever to go through the process. Sometimes it takes 12 to 15 sessions, unless there's a Pandora's box that opens up, and it could take 50 sessions. But usually, it can only take 5 to 8 sessions. What psychologists today are doing, like us young modern guys, is we're teaching patients how to actually handle these things themselves. So we're coaching them through being able to understand the symptomology, how you can actually control the symptoms, while we're helping you understand what is bringing on those symptoms, so you can actually learn to do self-management. And that's the actual key to modern day. We don't want people on the couch 4 days a week for the next 5 to 7 years. It's nice if you can afford it, and it's a luxury, And it does work.
But you do want to be in that situation where you can independently, like you said, you can see those symptoms, you can act on those symptoms and deal with them yourself. We're talking relationships, depression, anxiety, anything to do with mental health with Dr. Raymond Hamdan, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Lovely message that's come in. Many messages coming in on 64001 and on the Dubai Eye app. Saying no name on it, but this talk of today is so interesting. I'm studying psychology and counselling and can actually relate to some of these topics, so very good to hear. Whether you have a question or you've got a comment, send that through. Right now on the line we've got another caller. Is it Sayed? Sayil? Hello?
Yeah, this is Sayil. Good afternoon, Dr. Raymond.
Sayil, hello. Hi. Please give Dr. Raymond your question.
Hi, Dr. Raymond. This is Sal.
Hi, Sal.
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for asking. You know, not too many people ask me how I'm doing. They just expect me to ask them how they're doing. But, right. But thank you for asking. It's okay.
Great. I've got a sister, 33 years old. She's married, and she's got a 4-year-old daughter. And the current episode, which I and the family believes is the problem, which we think is the problem, is that she doesn't want to stay with her husband anymore. There were some episodes of financial problems with the husband and some other problems where she couldn't get those over.
Mm-hmm.
And now she does not want any contact with the family, which stood by on her side on all the occasions, morally, financially supported her, and she just blocks any help. Although she is independent, she lives on her own, she is a school teacher, she's very well educated, she teaches pupils above between the ages of 12 to 15 years old. So it's not really a problem which we could understand how we could help her and get out of this situation. But at least she could speak about these issues. If she wants separation, we can help her in that.
Yeah, how many children does she have?
Just one.
Did you see a lot of these kind of symptomologies before having a child, before
yes.
the marriage? Did you see these kind of symptoms when she was a teenager?
Yes, not when she was a teenager, when she was around 20 years old. She found somebody online, and it seemed like she got brainwashed, and she became very religious and didn't want to speak to people and confine her room herself to her place, and she acted abnormally. We went to see a psychiatrist back home, and then the psychiatrist actually couldn't come up with a conclusion, and he asked us about family history about such mental issues. And
so you don't know that your sister's been traumatized in any way, do you?
No, we have been. She lives close by. I pay her close visits all the time. It's like her life is in front of us.
What do you think about her emotional swings? Does she have a lot of mood swings where sometimes she's very happy and joyful, yes. and other times she's very sad and blue?
Yes, so she doesn't pretend to show the sad part. She is eager to show the happy part.
Uh-huh.
So
do you find I'm going to interrupt you. Do you find that she exaggerates a lot of situations, that she amplifies
yes.
moods?
Yes.
And if she has to be more happy than the bride at a wedding or more sad than the mourners at a funeral? She has to be the center of attention?
She avoids social situations where there's a lot of family and there's a lot of people. That
she avoids those.
Yes, she avoids those. So, but there were moments when she started her married life. She had a lot of love and compassion between her and her husband,
mm-hmm.
who still is her husband, but she has thrown her husband out of the apartment and she doesn't want to see him anymore. And then she allows him to come in and...
So there's a lot of indecisiveness with her. There's a lot of difficulty in making decisions. How is she as a mom?
She's a good mother, and she's
attentive to her child.
She's attentive to her child, and she says, "I will raise the child without this father," because she doesn't. What's gone wrong in the past 6 months is some typical husband and wife issues and the financial issues. The guy lost the job, but he got a job back. He's financially stable now. What I have understood is she has a victim mentality, that the whole world is against her. If you try to counsel her that the reasons which you were not speaking to your husband before, he has fulfilled them. The husband is pushing a lot to come back with her. He's not leaving her alone. He pushes a lot. He tries to spend money on her. He tries to take the family
out. He's trying to buy her love. Yes.
Exactly, to buy her love back and repent for his issues which were originally caused by financial problems and job loss.
Okay, let me mention something to you. It sounds like your sister has been traumatized. Now, I'm not sure if she's traumatized because of internal conflicts that she's suffering or it's actually because of external things that actually happened in this marriage. Relationships have been quite questionable for her. One is there's no such thing as a real online relationship. It's impossible. You can't build trust and respect based on somebody you meet online. It's not real enough. You don't see the person face to face. Even if you can see their face on a particular mechanism for communications, it's not the same thing as being able to sit at a dinner table or go to cinemas or even in each other's homes, depending on the culture that would allow that. So there's been a lot of conflict and confusion for her about relationships. And she may
I'll interrupt, but the online episode which happened was with another guy who just didn't happen. This guy, who was her husband, it wasn't an online situation.
No, I know that, but I'm saying, I mean, her history, what you're describing as her history, is some questionable relationship things that she may not have had the experiences to know how to maturely handle the things that are coming up. So what I'm suggesting to you is, as a loving, caring brother, you will want to address to her that you are concerned about her, and because of the emotional involvement that you do love her very much, you would like for her to consider seeing a professional who would help her sort out her mind, get things in order, look at where her priorities are, and if there is things like depression or anxiety or whatever else there might be, then that can be discovered to help her live a more comfortable life. Because what you're describing is an adjustment kind of situation. She's having difficulty adjusting to the circumstances. Money is never a reason to break up a relationship when money is going wrong. There's obviously some other traumas that are happening. But good luck to you and your sister, and hopefully we'll hear some good results in the future when you call us back.
Thank you so much.
For just one shot, can I say
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
All right.
All right, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. We're talking to Dr. Raymond Hamdan. He is clinical and forensic psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Just having a really interesting chat there, Dr. Raymond, off air about sleep, noises in sleep. It was kind of triggered by a question that we've had come in, this one on the Dubai Eye app, saying, my son grinds his teeth at night. It's actually very loud, so his teeth have been quite worn. What is the likelihood, she asks, of him growing out of bruxism? He is now six.
Well, bruxism is one of the diagnoses that dentists usually come up with because they see certain wear and tear on the teeth. However, when we have parents come in with their children saying our child does this, it is usually related to stress. And that stress can be for various reasons. It could be something they're dreaming about. It could be something that happened that day, something they're afraid of, something they're happy with. There could be a lot of reasons for it. It is usually symptomology rather than a diagnosis in itself. When it is a diagnosis in itself, it needs to be related to a pediatric dentist who handles these kind of cases. Seldom is it just psychological. It can't actually be both. However, when it is stress that's the basis for this and it's a symptom of the stress, that's when psychological intervention can be helpful.
So there's your answer. So it will be something that he can grow out of. Another texter coming in, this question. Hi, Dr. Raymond, a big fan of yours. My wife got a brain stroke. She is 41 years old. They treated her here. Now she's in Chicago after this incident. We have a fear of her having a stroke again, he says. He says that they are both active sports people. Is that something that you can assist with?
Well, yeah, there is a fear of these kind of things, of course, whenever there's an illness. And now, again, I'm not a neurologist, but whenever I've worked with neurologists on these kind of situations, whether it's people who suffer from seizures, epilepsy, and are more vulnerable, not because of seizure and epilepsy, to having stroke or other kinds of brain hemorrhages, what we're looking at here is that people are afraid that it will be repeated. It's not always repeated. And especially when they realize what the reason is that these have happened. It could be because of stresses in life. It could be because they've inherited a particular neurological process. It could be because of other kinds of mechanisms that are going on in their life that makes them more vulnerable to the circulatory system or neurological system. I can't be more intelligently describing what's going on because it isn't my specialty. But as a psychologist who've worked with these, I do know that qualified physicians, like neurologists, will do a thorough investigation on the history, but not just the person's history, their inherited history from both sides of the family that can bring these on. Is there vulnerability? You'll have to ask a neurologist what are the statistics for these to be repeated. Does that mean that it can happen? It probably can. Do these happen to anybody? Yes, it can happen to anybody. And what is the reason for it can be different reasons. So I'm not giving a clear-cut answer because I don't know the clear-cut answer, but what I'm suggesting is you talk to a neurologist who can give you better information, and it's always good to get a second opinion. Now, anywhere in the world, you do have your expertise. Chicago is one place, New York another, London, Moscow, Beijing, you know, there are many, many places around the world that have specialists in neurology that can actually help you understand what's going on and how to better deal with it as a family, not just for the patient.
Last couple of minutes to get your questions in for Dr. Raymond. This one's a bit of a moral dilemma. This person says, if a wife is aware of something that her husband is doing and is not proud of that he's doing, it's a bad habit. But the wife is managing somehow, but she doesn't want her son to learn about this that the dad is doing it. So they're giving the example of gambling. What would the woman do in this case in terms of saving face of her husband that he's doing something that is obviously very bad, but in front of her son, she also wants to put out the picture that you shouldn't be doing this?
What we're learning more about today is things like gambling and other compulsive disorders. So these kind of compulsive disorders can be treated. It is an addiction. And gambling can be an addiction, and it is treatable. It's not a thing to be ashamed of, even though people are ashamed of it. But when it's addiction, it's an addiction, whether it's because of drugs, alcohol, gambling, or any other kind of situation where a person cannot rid of the impulse to do it continuously, cannot control it, there is treatment for it. And the treatment requires both psychological and medical treatment. There are centers around the world that specialize in this. It is advisable many times that a person actually goes to a particular location where they will be at that location for anywhere from 4 weeks to 6 weeks to get intense treatment, both medical and psychological. These are located around the world that are addiction centers. And these addiction centers will serve people who have various kinds of addictions. Because an addiction is an addiction, regardless of how it manifests itself. And there are ways to solve this. It's not something that you have to live with forever. I can appreciate where mom may be concerned about her son. However, there is going to come a time where you will have to tell your son that he may be more vulnerable. Because even though gambling itself is not addiction, is not inherited, the addiction itself may be what's inherited, not the gambling. So when people have a tendency towards addiction, that addiction can manifest itself, whether it's alcohol, gambling, cigarettes, whatever the case may be. So children need to be aware of this as they get older, that they may be more vulnerable to this. And they may not know it until they start maybe socializing. And certain things happen during social times with their peers. And they realize that certain things get out of control. So you may need to tell your son at some point that he may be more vulnerable. It's not a matter of blaming dad. It's a matter of medical fact.
We've unfortunately come close to running out of time now. I'm just going to get you to quickly quickfire this last one. It feels as if my 8-year-old finds something to be anxious about. When she's ready early, she looks fine. She finds an issue with her hair or something else, and even though we agreed it earlier, she goes and changes everything. Any ideas about how I can help?
Yeah, there tends to be a perfectionistic quality here. Again, not knowing the child, I can't be exact what's going on until there's a chance to have met the child, met the family, and do an intake, which can take anywhere from 1 to 3 hours to do a thorough intake. But if there is a real problem here, other than just an 8-year-old who's very, very curious about her looks, and she may be getting this from modeling that she sees in the media or her peers or teachers or whoever else is involved in her life. There may be an obsession that's not necessarily going to hurt her, but it needs to be understood now to help subside it now. Here again, the best thing to do, because I can't give you the correct answer in this short of a time, even if I had more information, you need to see a third-party professional who specializes in these kind of things that'll help you as a family understand how to better manage it and help the child understand how to also manage it.
And that is the final word from Dr. Raymond Hamdan, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Thank you so much, Dr. Raymond. We'll see you again soon.
We'll look forward to that.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.